Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Look in the pantry or kitchen cabinet of any household, and you're likely to find one common item. A can of tuna. We'll explore that popular fish today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, welcome to A Taste of the Past here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio. And I mentioned that a can of tuna would probably be the one common item in any pantry or any kitchen cabinet. And as common as canned tuna is today, few Americans even ate tuna before the 20th century. And raw tuna was virtually unknown. So how did tuna rise out of obscurity in America? We're going to explore that today with the author Andrew F. Smith. Andy, to those of us who are on a one-to-one basis with him, Andrew has just published a brand new book called American Tuna, The Rise and Fall of an Improbable Food. Andy is a writer and a lecturer on food and culinary history and an author of 19 books?
Many.
Okay, 19, and an editor and author of 19 books. He teaches a course at the New School on Culinary History, and he's edited the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink in America.
We just call it the OEFDA, too.
There you go. All right. Andy, I'm welcome. I'm intrigued by this book. I read it cover to cover very quickly because I cannot imagine how such a book, it covers such a broad scope of social history, everything from U.S. foreign policy, immigration, environmental politics, food regulation, and of course, American dietary trends. Tell me, why didn't we know about tuna? The Mediterraneans, even the Romans, as you said, were eating tuna. Why was tuna unknown in America?
Well, part of the problem was that Englishmen didn't eat tuna. They're not a Mediterranean people. And so America, while it was settled with many different people, it was the English that dominated, and English cuisine which dominated. And tuna simply wasn't a part of their diet. So it is only after Mediterranean people started moving into America and people from Japan began to move into America on the West Coast that you begin to have an interest in tuna, but mm-hmm. it was limited in the 19th century to a very small group of people. Most Americans just simply didn't know about it, and those who did know about it thought it was a trash food. And also, if you look at the markets, the fish markets that were available, for instance, in New York or Los Angeles or Boston, you'll see thousands of different types of fish. And so they had this huge diversity of fish to choose from, and much of tuna is dark meat, and when you cook it, it turns a very unpleasant brown color.
Mm-hmm,
at least it does for the 19th century people.
And
so
does.
So they look at it and said, no, that's not what we want.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting because you say that it was considered not a pleasant fish. And often in your book, you refer to the fact that it was called an oily, smelly fish.
It is oily.
It is oily. But people were eating mackerel. They liked mackerel.
Well, it really isn't until they figured out how to get rid of the oil when mainstream Americans began to consume it. So I think that's part of it. And yes, it may be other fish, but mackerel is a part of English diet. So therefore, you accept things that are there, but don't necessarily accept things that are not Englishmen. Englishmen don't eat that.
True. So it was used as fertilizer and chicken
feed.
It was. Anything
else? If it were caught by accident, which indeed tuna was, I mean, they tried to sell it, and they even tried to sell it at cut rate prices for the poor. Even the poor didn't want it when they had alternatives, and so there are fish rendering plants that convert fish to oil in the 19th century before you had ethanol come on gasoline and that sort of thing. So it was for lighting and for all sorts of other purposes. But tuna oil wasn't that good, so they preferred whale oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, now explain to me, to our listeners, about tuna. Those who aren't maybe that familiar, they haven't gone to a fish market and seen, well, rarely in America do you get a chance to see an entire tuna. But tuna, the kind that we predominantly eat, are the albacore?
Actually, it's a little confusing because the tuna that most of us eat, skipjack, which isn't tuna at
all.
Right. So you really have a problem between a scientific definition and a biological definition and a consumer definition. So much of the dark meat that appears in tuna cans, for instance, is not a tuna species, but is skipjack, which is a relatively small fish and relatively easy to catch and proliferates all over the place. So so that's the main part. The top of the line, of course, is the bluefin, and the bluefin is the core food for sushi. And the latest tuna prices, for instance, on January 4th of this year, a single bluefin tuna cost $743,000 for a single fish.
And of course, we learned a lot about that once the Japanese came in, but bring us back.
You have a number of varieties that are, and the smaller one would be the albacore, and the albacore is what most of us are familiar with, and albacore was very common on the West Coast and is very common in the Pacific, so that is one of the two fish that, and the tuna species that are not stressed at this time.
So the tuna fishing really began more on the West Coast?
There were some attempts at fishing on the East Coast, but it was really by sports fishermen who were looking to catch a big fish. And so what they would do is they have hand rigs. They would put the line into the water, and they would wait till the tuna bit into it, and then they would let it swim around, and then they would haul it in when it tired out, and they would have their picture taken with it, and they would then send the tuna off to the fertilizer factory or send it off to the oil conversion. So some of that did happen on the East Coast, but it's on the West Coast that the tuna industry that we know and the tuna canning industry begins, and it's quite by accident. It isn't as though somebody said, oh, this is where we're going to go catch tuna. They really had a canning factory in San Pedro, California, that was looking for sardines, which was a common part of American diet at that point.
Right.
And the sardines didn't appear one year. And so they had to change to other fish. And there was lots of fish in the San Pedro Bay and in the Catalina Islands area. So they just started catching other fish. And they canned different types of fish, one of which was albacore. And they found a process whereby, after years of 3 or 4 years of experimentation of how they could get rid of the oil and how they would only can the white meat of the albacore. So 25% of the fish was used for that purpose. The rest of it was still put into fertilizer and still put into oil. So it is that which begins the tuna industry. And as strange as this is, at the time, biologically, albacore wasn't considered a tuna species. It is today, but it wasn't then. So no one knew what albacore was, and so they had to create very creative ways of trying to get Americans to eat it. And the obvious one was, it tastes like chicken.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So that's the promotion part.
Or what one, somebody said, a fishy veal.
A fishy veal. Right. All sorts of different people came along and had different definitions, but it was the taste like chicken that
chicken
stuck.
Chicken of the sea.
It stuck. Right. And so you had a commercialization of it in America. And of course, it is a very mild taste. Once you remove the oil, it's a very mild tasting fish. And mm-hmm. so therefore, you could, every tuna, every chicken recipe that you had, you could actually substitute tuna for. So tuna salad, chicken salad, tuna noodle casserole, chicken casserole. I mean, you could have all sorts of things with it.
Well, prior to the Americans getting in on the canning industry, I mean, it had been canned in,
yes.
in France or in Portugal.
There was some low-level canning in Portugal and in Italy and in France, in southern mm-hmm. France, and it was considered in the Mediterranean, it was a common food, but outside of the Mediterranean, it was an upper-class food, and that was sold in Delmonico's restaurant, for instance, here in New York, and other haute cuisine restaurants. But it's canned or salted tuna that will come in and that will be prepared in special ways. But that's the exception, not the rule.
Well, you write that even as late as the 1880s, the U.S. Commission of Fish and Fisheries reported that although occurring in large numbers and of remarkable size, and I quote from your book, no effort is made toward their capture. Well, you explained that
yeah.
started to change. And even one prescient writer for, what was it, the Fishing Gazette, said that a time will probably come when it will form a more important feature of marketable fish. Wow, he should have banked on that one.
Yeah.
I'll bet you he should have said.
Yeah, well, here's my wager, yes.
Yeah, right. Because then the canning industry just took off. You also gave some interesting numbers on immigration, and I was astounded at the more than exponential growth of the Mediterranean
yes.
population. I mean, that in the 1850s, there were only 4,000 documented Italian descent living in America.
Of Italian heritage, yes.
Yeah.
Not just people who immigrated from Italy, it's Italian heritage.
Even with background,
and
right.
it's after the Civil War that you begin to have this massive immigration from Italy. But it's not just from Italy. It's also from the Azores, and mm-hmm. it's from what's today the former Yugoslavia, and it's from the Mediterranean islands and things of that sort. So you have people that were very familiar with tuna, that knew how to catch it, they knew how to prepare it, and they loved eating it. And so that at least becomes a minority food in New York and those places that had large immigrant populations.
So fast forward to the 20s. I mean, the canning industry just took off.
Yeah, it's really the first known tuna can rolled off the assembly line in 1904. It was essentially a failure in 2005, 2006, 2007. It's only in 2008 that they excuse me, 1908. My mind is
yeah,
in a different
right.
century now. It's only in 1908 that you really begin to have the commercialization of tuna. When they figure out how to do it, at that point they figured out that they could sell it, that there was a large immigrant group that would buy it, even if they couldn't attract mainstream Americans, and then they start advertising and promoting it.
Yeah.
And in a very short period of time, it goes from one factory that's canning tuna to 5 factories to 15 factories to 30 factories, and that's a period of about 5 years. So it's something that just is the right time and the right place and the right fish.
So they really changed Americans' perception. I mean, the perception had been that of a, as you say, a repulsive bottom feeder.
Yeah.
Well, and then it became this you know, tasty. Well,
the changing perception actually begins earlier, and it starts with a very unlikely group of people, sports fishermen.
Yeah.
And sports fishermen in America, I mean, the freshwater sports fishing industry, or excuse me, fishing you know, professionals begin to have their own clubs and that sort of thing, and actually in the 18th century. But they never applied their principles of sports fishing to
catch and release.
to ocean fishing.
Oh.
And so it is the sports fishermen that go to Catalina in the late 1890s that begin to catch these fish that are 300, 400, 500 pounds, and some will end up at 1,000 and 1,500 pounds. And this makes news all over America. And so it's not only men, it's also women. And they're catching these fish, and they're having their picture taken with them, and they're having their tuna stuffed, and they're sending their tuna back to their home, and they're putting it over their fireplace. I mean, it's a whole thing. And the amazing thing is the front page coverage that this gets in newspapers all over the United States. You have the beginning of fishing magazines that start at the same time, mm-hmm. and they start telling these tales. And as soon as this happens, professional fishermen start flocking to Southern California to catch these big fish.
Yeah, they're that big, there's a profit in it somewhere.
Well, right? There's a profit of at least not make selling it, but profit of catching it and struggling with this fish. And by the way, as all the early evidence indicates, the tuna usually won the fight. So the tuna, they had reaped a whole series of fish hooks and reels, and even fishermen were pulled overboard by these fish. I mean, they're huge, and they're powerful.
And they do put up a good fight.
And they do put up a good fight, and so it becomes a sports fish to begin with.
Well, you wrote, too, about how a lot of professional fishermen despise the tuna because they would ruin their nets. I mean, they were aggressive.
Yeah. Right? Historically, the bluefin would be chasing the same fish that the fishermen are after, and the bluefin was big enough where they would go right through the rope nets that they had and would go through one side, eat what was inside the nets, and then go right out the other side. So fishermen were not happy with the big tuna, the albacore and others. So, and those were those that, particularly on the East Coast, that they were familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Well, the canning industry mostly relied, you say, on frozen tuna. So we've got a couple things happening here. We've got bird's eye coming in, and
that's not until you have albacore is the tuna fish to begin with, and of course albacore will be depleted in the areas that the fishermen were going for, and so they start replacing it with other species, and yellowfin is a good example, and then skipjack and other fish that they begin to can in the name of tuna, mm-hmm. and that's it. In the 1920s, it is cheaper to import frozen tuna from Japan, which is by far the single largest and most professional tuna group in the world at that time. And they imported there into the United States and frozen. And so you had small canneries that depended on this frozen tuna that was coming in to Seattle, where the fish themselves weren't available off the coast. And so they had this tuna industry that really is bifurcated to begin with. And, of course, as the 30s go on, as the 40s go on, and the anti-Japanese feeling increases in America, this is all part of what happens before World War II.
Well, and then you talk a lot about how the canning industry, you say, you just mentioned that through advertising, they became very popular, and they hired people to write recipes and write booklets.
They did.
Booklets are a whole. That's a whole other book right there too booklets.
That's a part of my professional interest in tuna began when I started acquiring these tuna booklets from the earliest one I had was 1912. But there are probably about 50 of them that each company put out. And the problem was Americans might be convinced to buy something called Chicken of the Sea, but they needed, what do you do with it?
Right.
And at that point, cookbooks did not have tuna recipes in them. And cooking magazines had relatively few recipes for cooking and preparing tuna. So consequently, you begin to have these little booklets that came out by the companies, and they gave them away. Mm-hmm. And they're tremendous. They're beautiful. And they're really wonderful color, spectacular, and I'm delighted that I was able to collect as many
well,
as I did.
Well, you also mentioned, this amazed me, that that industry was one of the first to begin printing recipes right on the label of the cans.
I know of no other can manufacturer that printed recipes on there. And again, in part, it's a new food that comes onto the American diet. So you need recipes, and not everybody is going to get the tuna cook booklet, so consequently, they put these recipes on them.
Right on the can. And then they came out with the brilliant idea of to peel off the label and have the recipe on the inside of the label?
Yeah, it starts. You can only do one on the inside and still have your brand name and have all the other information that you needed to have on it, the picture and whatnot. But on the inside of it, you could put all sorts of different recipes. They had three recipes. They had dozens of different types, and so you actually could buy a cookbooklet. You could acquire a cookbooklet by just getting the labels and taking them off of several different versions of
paste them on a page,
and they have numbers on them, so you know from from the outside what the recipes are on the inside. So
well, that recipe printing on the inside labels, that persists today.
But I have not seen
on tuna, but on other things like evaporated milk, I think, or sweetened condensed milk and a few things.
Yeah, I've never seen it on anything else. And so to the best of my knowledge, that was the first use of it.
Yeah, amazing. Well, we're going to talk about some of those historical recipes and uses of tuna and the introduction of raw tuna and people eating fresh tuna when we come back after a short break.
You're listening to I'm Not Gonna Cry by Sharon Jones and the Dab Kings.
Grass-fed beef, pasture-raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Okay, now to use an Andy Smith method, I'm going to say, raise your hand if you've never had a tuna sandwich. Ooh, there are no hands raised out there.
Does life exist without consuming a tuna sandwich?
Oh, come on, or a tuna salad or something. I'm talking with Andy Smith, the author of American Tuna, The Rise and Fall of an Improbable Food. And Andy, I joke because Andy uses this raise your hand method a lot in his lectures, and it's very effective, I might add.
You got to get people doing something.
That's right.
Just sitting there, they fall asleep.
Participatory lecture, right? But true, who hasn't had a tuna salad sandwich or a tuna salad? Stuffed in a tomato or something, and you do include some wonderful recipes. Some I just are new to me, but the ever-present tuna noodle casserole, and we're going to talk about those in a minute. But first, I want to cover. We established that the perception of tuna became more acceptable to the American public, and canned tuna took off. Now we have the introduction of fresh tuna, and more than fresh tuna, the introduction of raw tuna.
If someone had asked me when I grew up in the 1950s that anybody would be eating raw tuna, I would have said that they're crazy and that they need to be put in an insane asylum someplace. That was simply not on a mainstream American agenda.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't even on the Japanese community agenda. There were certainly some restaurants that had raw tuna, but by and large, it wasn't even a part of Japanese food that prepared in the United States for the Japanese community. So it was here, but it was not a big deal. And that was one of the things that when I started the book, I wanted to ask, how could this happen that Americans could be convinced to consume raw fish? And so part of that was remembering back to my own early childhood and remembering, no, you can't eat raw food. You can't, got to do this, got to do that. And it really is an unusual story that does not start in Los Angeles, where you would have expected it to, with the large Japanese community or the southern or the West Coast, but it starts in New York, where there's a very small group of Japanese restaurateurs who are here. But they were discovered by Craig Claiborne. And Craig Claiborne was food columnist for the New York Times. And he discovered them and started writing about this. Well, Americans wouldn't like this raw fish stuff, but it's here. It's pretty good. And in a period of like 2 years, from 1961 to 1963, all of a sudden he said, this is the greatest thing I've ever had before. Then he goes to Japan and he comes back and he tells all of these wonderful things about these sushi bars and things of that sort. And other food writers then began picking it up. You had more high-end Japanese restaurants opening, not just in New York, but in other cities as well. And sushi becomes a part of that. And then you have the shift and change with the immigration laws making it possible for professionals to immigrate into the United States, in this case, sushi chefs. And if they'd stayed in Japan, it would have taken them years to become a sushi master. But
that's right.
They can start off, be good chefs and come to America, get huge visibility. And many of them did that. They made a lot of money. Then they went back, and they were sushi master by the time they got back in Japan.
Yeah.
So you had this all of a sudden, everything together at the same time. That created this love of sushi, which now is mainstream. It's
well, backing up to when we were talking about the fishing for tuna, and you said the Japanese had the best, that we were importing
yes.
tuna from them, but the and immigration of the sushi chefs. Immigration was a big problem,
yes,
in terms of the fishing and in terms of how we were protecting our fishing rights. And
well, yeah, there were two different issues. One was that there was an anti-Asian hysteria that went on the West Coast, and that started because of Chinese immigration that was relatively large in terms of the total population of the West Coast at that time. And the Japanese simply got the tail end of that anti-Asian feeling and the nativist mood in California. Then you had Hearst newspaper, not having to do with the Hearst farm,
yes.
that begins to engage in this anti-Japanese rhetoric that goes on for almost 20 years, just before World War, and obviously crescendos in the World War II itself. So you have these different things that are going on with regard to immigration. In 1924, the United States shut off all immigration from all other countries, with a few minor exceptions. And so it is the tuna industry, that it is the Japanese fishermen that are the core of the tuna industry for catching albacore. You could not do that with nets. They didn't know how to do that with nets and still save the albacore, so they had to do it with hand lines, and it was only the Japanese who were professionals at catching that. So it's the Japanese fishermen that really start the American tuna industry.
Mm-hmm. So then, and then followed years later, our love of sushi, and then
you had this whole new shift that occurs beginning in the 1960s, 1970s, and then of course you have Shogun in 1980. And as soon as Shogun happens, the love of anything Japanese is now the hit of America, and
right.
everybody's got to try. Can you remember the first time you sampled sushi?
Definitely.
I know exactly the location at the time. I thought I was going to die after I consumed it. I mean, intellectually I knew I wouldn't. But it was always all these things that had been.
Well, what was beautiful was the whole aesthetic surrounding, you know, the.
Well, everybody else was eating it.
How you do it.
Everybody else was doing it. I don't really eat that kind of thing, right. You know.
So. And we do have to credit the food writers for making it popular.
I credit the food writers for popularizing it, and I credit restaurateurs for really
embracing
it and making it a tremendous part of American food today.
That's right. A friend's son, David Gelb, has made a fabulous film called Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
And I have it.
It's a wonderful film.
Yeah.
Anyone who you'll get hungry looking at it, but it's a wonderful film that really makes you appreciate, as you said, how long it takes to become a sushi master in Japan.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do.
And you do get to see the big whole tunas, which is great. Well, question, okay, in comes the, as you call it, the tuna wars, but there are the problems with regulations. There's a problem with fishing activists, and the dolphins catching the dolphins getting caught in the net or using the dolphins to attract the. I mean, there's all kinds of things get embroiled in the whole tuna fishing industry, and then we have, of course, the mercury scare.
Yeah,
canned tuna as well as fresh tuna.
Yep.
What are we up to now? How many parts per million are we allowed to consume? of mercury, of the methyl mercury?
To make this a long story short, the answer is the best scientific evidence, and there's certainly some people who disagree with it, is that unless you eat 5 cans of tuna a day, white tuna in particular, that and not skipjack and not dark tuna, but white tuna, you won't have any problem with methyl mercury. The problem is methyl mercury goes in your body, and it has at least a 50-day half-life, and so it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. So if you eat a little, the body can handle that, and it's not any big deal. The exception to that, and the one thing that I have told friends, if you are pregnant, don't consume tuna. And and this is also controversial, because there's some people that said, well, all the good things that are in tuna you are better than just a little methyl mercury. And my attitude
low fat, high protein.
Yeah, but you can eat a lot of other fish that don't have any methyl mercury at all. So why not get the low fat, high protein from other fish source? And that is a concern, because in this case, you know, children and babies in particular don't have any mechanism of getting rid of the methyl mercury like adults do. And so it stays there. And there's some evidence that indicates that it can cause brain damage. And it's not worth the risk. So that is my only piece of advice based on all the research. And again, it's a 30-year time in which this research has gone from one end saying even canning, you know, even a little can of tuna is going to kill you to all sorts of things. There is no evidence in America that any tuna with any amount of methyl mercury has ever caused any problem with anyone. So it doesn't mean that it doesn't have a long-term effect that you couldn't measure. But that's my best assessment of
it. Right. Well, have we exhausted our supply of natural tuna with overfishing?
That was my concern. I will not eat certain species of tuna. I will not eat bluefin. I will not eat yellowfin. I will not eat big eye. The big ones that are, the populations are stressed. On the bluefin, Atlantic bluefin tuna, the best evidence is 80% of the tuna stock that was around in 1970 is gone. And the thought used to be, if we restricted catching bluefin, for instance, then we would give an opportunity for the population to recover. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, there's no evidence that supports that. The cod industry is a good example. Canada put this huge prevention of Canadians from catching cod in, I think, 1994. And the idea was, if we stopped doing it, 40,000 people lost their jobs overnight in the tuna industry, or the cod industry in Canada. And the thought was, well, in a few years, the cod population will recover. It hasn't recovered yet. So the answer is, what you think, oh, yeah, if we stop catching them, then they're going to go back to where they were. And the answer is no, that's not true, or at least no evidence for that. So my end personal answer is, I'm not going to eat bluefin, and I love the taste of it.
Yeah. So. Well, you write that you write about some of the Japanese efforts to farm.
Yeah, there are some good possibilities. I don't know if farmed bluefin is going to make it. Mm-hmm. It just takes too long, and it's too resource dependent. I mean, you have to feed bluefin for years.
It's going to be a mighty expensive piece of fish.
And you have to feed them a diet that they're familiar with. You can't feed them corn like you can a cow or a pig or something of that sort. You really have to feed them fish. And so it's a huge undertaking. And Japanese have claimed that they have succeeded in doing in farming a bluefin. And that may be a possibility. A better thought is, a single female bluefin will have as many as 30 million eggs in a year. And so of those, only 3 will grow, traditionally, only 3 would grow to adulthood. And so the answer is, it may be possible in the future to get those 30 million eggs, and if seeding works, that you can have more of them survive, and that may be a long-term solution too.
Well, we may see this whole cycle of the rise and fall go round and round again, right?
Maybe. Yeah, my hope is that's the case. Yeah.
Well, before we finish up, I do want to talk a little bit about some of these wonderful recipes that you include.
I was hoping you'd ask.
I mean, who doesn't remember from their childhood? Well, if you grew up in the 60s or 70s, or even 80s, I suppose, tuna noodle casserole, or tuna nuna, as one of my daughter's friends always called it.
We're growing up Catholic, and of course, in the 50s and the 60s, you were required to eat fish on Friday, or could not eat meat on Friday. So it would be tuna sandwich at noon, and it would be tuna noodle casserole at night. And so I love those. You know, to me, it was just it was something that I loved in my youth, and I still love them today.
Well, it is funny. You mentioned that it has come back. It did have a little resurgence as comfort food, and it is. Yeah. There's nothing bad about it. It's good. And of course, then, as you mentioned too, you know, the soup industry got in, canned soup industry got in on it. Campbell's, you know, said, hey, here's a recipe using canned tuna and canned soup, and there you got it, noodle.
And I like that recipe, too.
It is good. Far
be it for me to be commercial about this, but I think the recipe that they have on, that they've promoted over the years is actually a very good one. So.
All right. Tell me what one of the, you did some research on these old recipes with the booklets and all. What were a couple of the more unusual, or you're making a grimace, all right, with that face. What was the most unusual recipe you ran across?
I mean, there were recipes. The idea of these cook booklets to begin with was to replace tuna with anything that you got a hold of. And
you said any chicken recipe could be.
Any chicken recipe. But those things are obvious and easy to do. But then they had start recipes with canned tuna and asparagus. Well, okay. Mm-hmm. And then they would have, tuna with all sorts of things. You know, some of the obvious things are tuna salad works out very well, and then tuna salad easily goes into a sandwich. And so those are certainly parts of it. They tried to do, there were some tuna tartare recipes, which I personally wouldn't try, although I like tuna tartare that's available today. But those, they were doing it at a time when they were not fully aware of how to preserve the tuna tartare to make sure that it was edible.
What about tuna chop suey? You had something. I saw that. That made me cringe. But
well, I mean, what is chop suey?
Suey
is anything that anybody made that you had left over. And I mean, historically, it's an Americanization.
It's not even Chinese.
It's not
right?
even Chinese. And so it's Chinese restaurants that begin to serve it and, of course, get the visibility for it. But once you realize that there is no recipe, there is no traditional recipe for chop suey, you can add anything you want. And so why not add a little tuna in? And why not? I've not personally tried that, but that seems reasonable to me to just say, let's put tuna in everything and see what happens.
Yeah, and tuna pudding. Okay, I'm sorry. That
I didn't try that one either.
But
I had to put it in just because I thought it was unusual and somewhat different. So.
Well, as we started out saying, the Mediterraneans had been eating tuna for a long time. And, of course, Italians always had a tradition of having a tuna sauce for pasta. And, of course, the classic veal tonnazzo.
Sure.
Veal with the tuna sauce. Well, there you got the fishy veal and the tuna. They finally meet together in one dish.
Well, you can do so many tuna because at least the canned tuna is relatively tasteless. This isn't going to sound right, but it's essentially bland. You can add it into virtually anything that you like, mm-hmm. and in one sense, you can add whatever flavoring you like too.
That's right.
So, in one sense, that's one of the reasons on why tuna became such a success. A stronger tasting fish would never have had the success and haven't had the success that tuna has.
Yeah. Well, and we could talk longer. I'm running out of time, but. About the canning industry. I mean, you know, they took the oil out and then they packed it back in oil again. Well, it's good. It tastes good. But I don't know, the brainy idea to put it in spring water. Boy, it loses all taste whatsoever. I don't know. You might be eating cardboard.
Because it starts in California, it really started with olive oil. And olive oil, of course, was plentiful. It was plentiful and it was popular at the time. And it does have a very different flavor than fish oil does.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
So it is the olive oil that gives the fish the flavor, gives the tuna fish the early flavor that people loved. And so in one sense, it's one of the reasons on why tuna was adopted so quickly. But the idea with water, of course, is, well, oil in it has lots of calories, and we were consuming tuna because it doesn't have many calories. It's low in calories and high in protein. So,
okay,
I mean,
truth.
At least that's the idea behind it. To me, also, I agree with you. It doesn't taste as good.
Yeah. And the truth of the matter is there's very little difference in calories.
Well, if you strain the oil out of the can, it's not that much difference.
No. Right. All right, America, we're going to go, the way I'm going to close this is we started out saying American tuna.
American tuna.
Okay, the rise and fall of an improbable food. What's American left about it? The canning companies, are they American?
Yeah.
No.
No. There's no major tuna factory left in the United States. There is some tuna canning going on in American Samoa, quite but whether or not that will survive is a big issue. And most of the tuna there is imported in from other countries. So most of the tuna that we consume in the United States today comes from Southeast Asia and from the Pacific, and not caught by American tuna boats or whatnot.
So the companies that we come to know and trust with American names are not even American-owned anymore.
Not anymore.
Sorry,
but
Charlie.
But that's part of the whole globalization movement in food. So
that's
not
true.
It's not just unique to tuna, and the price of tuna is not gone up as much as every other food item has.
That's right.
It's been really it is one of the best buys on the market today.
That's true. That's
so
true.
To me, I was interested in how a tuna industry started in America, and then how its demise, its fall, and it fell in a very short period of time, a 20-year period of time. You had the largest tuna industry in the world in the United States, and about a few decades you have no tuna industry in the United States at all. And so, and part of that was good decisions. It's not just methylmercury, and it's not just fishing on poor dolphins and all of the other international rigmarole. It's also simply because of foreign policy. American made choices in foreign policy, and the idea was you need to have trade with Japan, and this was one thing that the Japanese could provide after World War II, and we didn't have to support it with financial contributions, which we were doing up until that time.
That's
so,
right.
Lots of reasons.
Well, you do a wonderful job of covering all that and more in this new book, American Tuna, and it's been a pleasure, as always, speaking with you, Andy Smith. Thanks for joining. I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.